Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to another weekend. I am so excited to sit back and unwind from the week that was with two excellent humans. With us this week, we have Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, inventor of the Cascatelli pasta shape, and author of the new cookbook, Anything is Possible. Dan, welcome back.
Hey, Greta. Thanks for having me.
Also here is the delightful Helen Rosner, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the newsletter The Food Scene. Helen, welcome back.
Hey, Greta.
Okay, so this week we are going to play a game that we have really been enjoying here at Nerdette. It is called Burden or Delight. It is very simple. There are no stakes at all and also no prizes either. The idea is we're going to talk about some stuff. We're going to do all food stuff this week, and we get to decide whether the thing is a burden or a delight. So my thought was that we could start with the idea of the IT restaurant, because I think this is kind of an interesting one. I mean, it's definitely happened to me here in Chicago, where I've had like a delightful neighborhood bakery get a mention in, say, the New York Times or whatever, and then all of a sudden there's a line around the block. And while I am very happy for them, I am very sad for me and the amount of time it takes for me to get whatever delicious pastry I wanted. Helen, how do you feel about this one?
Oh, I feel complicated about
right?
it.
Yeah.
I think of that as the hug of death, to borrow a term from the internet. You know, back in the day, if a particular URL suddenly became really popular, like a website went viral, everyone would visit it and the site would crash, and call that the hug of death. Like, we loved it so much that it was destroyed. And nowhere, I think, is that more obvious and evident than in the world of IT foods and IT restaurants, where suddenly, especially through something like TikTok or social media in general, something just blows up. And it is kind of a mixed bag. Like, it's hard not to feel a little bit of a sense of not gatekeeping, but like, I was there, right? Like, I loved you before I was told to love you. And now that everyone's on board, there aren't enough muffins for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I feel like it also is often a struggle for the actual restaurant, right? Because like, who knows if they even have the infrastructure to be able to facilitate that many people coming to the place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a huge amount of hype is often doesn't work out well for anybody.
Yeah,
because the restaurant's overwhelmed. But like Helen said, like, you know, if you were someone who was eating it before it became super cool, then you're going to go back after it's hot, and you're going to be wondering, is it the same? Is it not the same? Is it good as I remember? It becomes hard to judge things objectively because there's so much baggage now. I mean, even if they haven't changed the recipe, and even if it is, even if they'll tell you it is exactly the same, it may not feel the same or taste the same to you. And if you're coming to it newer and you didn't have it before it blew up, then you're also like, there's all so much hype attached to it. I will say, like, one thing I'm wondering, I would love to hear both of your takes on this. You know, yes, in some cases, I think that like a place will face a lot of pressure to grow too quickly, and that can affect quality. I've seen it happen with things that I've fallen in love with, like a Belgian waffle place that used to do homemade whipped cream, and then when they expanded, they switched to canned whipped cream, mm-hmm. which is fine. I have that in my own house, but like, you know, the real good stuff, you know, you do taste the difference.
Yeah.
But then you look at something like the Cronut. Okay, the Cronut, which went so crazy viral. And Dominique Ansel still, I think to this day, is only making like 300 of them a day or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you can buy the tickets in advance. Mm-hmm. And it's now a thing that pretty much only tourists do. And I sort of feel like I've never had a Cronut, because the other issue for me is I'm not going to wait in line for just about anything. Okay?
Right.
So as soon as it becomes that, you know, as soon as it becomes that crowded, I'm not going to bother. And so I've never had a Cronut. And I... But it bothers me because I think that he could make more than 300 a day, without yeah. sacrificing quality. So to me, in that situation, I think it's actually more like artificial scarcity.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about that with places too, where it's like, couldn't y'all get a bigger space at this point? Like, I imagine you could afford square footage that would facilitate more people sitting and then paying at one time, you know?
Right. Helen, isn't there some happy medium between industrialization and extreme scarcity?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think what you were saying too about like the Cronut, which I think is the poor example of this, the combination of waiting in line versus doing a ticketed system. The other thing that that takes away from this process is the experience, right? It shifts all the focus onto the food itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say the food is not important when it comes to food, but it's not 100% of the game, right? Of going out to a burger is the restaurant that you're sitting in. And some of the vibe of the restaurant that you're sitting in is, how crowded is this restaurant? How much pressure do I feel under to turn this table within 15 minutes? Because I have 200 people staring daggers at me from outside the window because they want to get in out of the rain.
So I feel like the more we talk about it, the more it feels like the answer to this is actually burden. Or are we sticking with mixed bag? What do y'all think?
Oh, we're burning. We're burning 100%.
Yeah. There's very little positive. I mean, I'm sure there are some examples out there of a place that suddenly became the it place and was able to navigate that sudden intense rush of business and attention in a way that, you know, was overall a net positive for them over the long term. And so I'm happy for that business that they're doing well.
That one business.
Right. But I think that it just as often ends up crushing the place and also ruining the food and the customer experience. So I go burden.
Okay. Yeah. Burden. Yeah. Okay. So the next one I wanted to ask y'all about is something that's really controversial, but I'm not sure that it will be with this group, but it's just mayonnaise. I feel like this is one where people have really strong opinions and a lot of people really don't like mayo.
I think
I'm going to go full delight on that.
Yeah.
100% delight. I think the people who are hating on mayonnaise are having foods that have too much mayonnaise.
Yes. Yes.
And like, yes, there is such thing as too much.
Yes.
You know, like I don't want a turkey sandwich with like tablespoons and tablespoons of mayo glopped all over it.
No.
But in small amounts, it is the most quintessential sandwich spread.
Yes. Most necessary.
I would never just want like Dijon mustard. I would always want Dijonnaise. There's a great cookbook actually coming out next week by my friend Elise Whitney. It's called Big Dip Energy. It's all dips. And Elise uses mayo as a baseline ingredient in a range of dips so well and creatively. And it physically holds things together. It adds richness and creaminess and a little bit of tanginess and umami. And I'm all about mayo.
Oh my God. I love that so much.
I love mayo. I have one caveat.
Okay. That's fair.
My caveat is that there is a billboard not far from my home in Brooklyn that is an advertisement for a particular mayonnaise manufacturer who I will not call out by name. And it is an enormous billboard that is an intentionally grotesque close-up of mayonnaise on some vegetables on a sandwich. And it is the grossest thing I've ever seen in my life. And like, I love mayonnaise. And this billboard that is playing into the idea of loving mayonnaise is possibly going to put me
Oh, no. Oh, I hope you can handle it. Because that sounds extremely unappetizing. Extremely unappetizing.
Yeah.
Okay, so another one I wanted to run by y'all is room temperature butter. And I'm going to explain why I feel like this one is a little bit both burden and delight, because there is nothing better than like having softened butter that you can spread onto toast or banana bread or whatever the hell it is. However, I have the hardest time keeping it from going bad if I leave it out all the time. And I got one of those little like cute water inversion, you know, butter bells or whatever you call those. And I just can't seem to make it work. I guess maybe the problem is that I'm just not eating enough butter. Is that what it is?
Yeah, Greta, this sounds like a you problem, not a butter problem.
Okay, well then we'll just go with delight and I'll leave it at that.
I have a butter bell also, and sometimes we go through phases where you go a few weeks without using it and the butter will go bad.
Yeah.
So it's not a perfect system. Maybe they should invent a smaller one that holds just a half a stick of butter instead of a whole stick.
I think that would help me, yes.
Maybe that would be better. You know. So I don't want to completely dismiss your concern, Greta. It is valid. But yeah, I think to me, like it's the, like that is, this is, I mean, Helen can comment better on this because she is a real restaurant critic, unlike me. But to me, when a restaurant puts butter on the table and it's hard as a rock,
oh,
that is like a huge negative to me in how I perceive the whole restaurant. It's the smallest thing, but it's just an indication of how much care are you putting into everything. Mm-hmm. And for you to serve nice hot bread on the table when I walk in with rock hard butter just tells me that, like, you're not on your game.
That was a plot line in Succession, wasn't it?
The butter's too cold! The butter is too cold! The butter's all fucked! Now you fuck watching, you fuck it. There's dinner rolls ripping out there
Potter.
As we speak!
Potter!
I am a laughing stock!
It is definitely like one of those, you know, as Stan says, like a quality shibboleth, right? Like, if mm-hmm. you put the effort into the butter, I feel confident that you're going to be putting the effort into everything else. And especially because, like, nobody likes cold butter, right? There are some arguments for some bizarre restaurant choices that this is being done intentionally. This is how we want it to happen. This is some version of an optimal experience. There is nobody on earth. I would love to meet this person, like, call into the show. Like, who prefers cold butter to warm butter? Nobody. Literally.
Yeah, no.
Well, maybe the health inspector.
That's true.
That's the person the restaurants are worried about, right, Helen? That's why the butter's in the fridge at all.
I don't know, man. I think the reason the butter's in the fridge is because it's easier to pre-prep, you know, 700 plates worth of butter and keep them in the deep fridge. And then the worst, like, right, just when you thought it couldn't get worse than fridge cold butter on the table at the restaurant is when it's fridge cold butter that smells like the fridge.
No.
Right. And like even the plate is cold. Like, you know, this whole thing has been sitting in the fridge for God knows how long. Yeah.
I don't want my butter to have flavor foreshadowing for the rest of the
No, no, thank you. Flavor foreshadowing. Helen, your turns of phrase are just beautiful. I love them so much. Dan, you brought a topic. Would you like to present the case for food photography?
Oh, burden or delight, taking pictures of what you're eating. As a person who works in food, I feel like it's sort of my job. And yes, you know, like, it makes me happy if I can, you know, send a little love to a place that I'm eating at and it helps their business is nice. But when my food comes, I'm hungry and I want to eat it.
Yes.
If I've cooked something, I'm hungry and I want to eat it. And I don't want to have to take time to line up the perfect shot and find the lighting to share this thing that, like, the world probably actually doesn't really need. And so I find having to take a photo of my food, which I don't do all the time. Like, I'm not great at social media. I should do it more often. As a food podcaster, I should do it more often. I'm sure I'd have more social media followers if I did. But I don't, because I try to carve out some time for me to focus on enjoying what I'm eating.
Yeah.
But I do feel, this does feel like a burden to me, but I'm curious to hear what you two think.
Yeah, I kind of think full burden on, I think to your point, because we got to be able to eat the food. I do think I like, especially if I take something right out of the oven and it has to cool anyway, I might try and snap a pic of it, but otherwise, no, I think it is pretty much full burden. What do you think, Helen?
I think it is largely burden, but I do have a carve out for a way that I really appreciate it, which is that I have to take pictures of almost everything I eat out at restaurants as part of my job, because I've got to send them along to the fact checkers to make sure that I'm writing accurately about the things that I eat. And thank goodness for all of the other people at restaurants who are taking pictures of their food, because then I don't stand out and look like a weirdo trying to try to stay under the radar. You know, people know what I look like, but, you know, I try to make reservations under fake names and things like that. And so if I'm whipping out my phone and being like, no, I got to take a picture of the food, I don't stand out. And I appreciate all of the other dedicated food photographers who are providing me with suppressing fire. So that can make this-
I think that's a great caveat. I respect it.
Yeah.
Okay. So before I let y'all go, I would love to do one more, which is expiration dates, burden or delight.
I mean, on a certain level, like, physiologically a good thing, right?
Right. Right. Like, food safety is cool. We respect that.
But they are really a source of far more stress than I think they ought to be, right? Yeah. Like, I think at this point, most people understand that the dates that are printed on packages are usually sell-by dates rather than use-by dates.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you buy it on the 27th and that's the date on the package, you've got a few days of grace period to use whatever. But I don't know. This is like a science and health communication issue, right?
Yes. And a capitalism issue, I think,
and
too,
capitalism,
right?
For sure. Yeah. You know, I this morning with my breakfast had some jam from a jar that expired in 2019.
Nice.
But I opened the jar fresh today. I have, as a sidebar, a huge condiment hoarding problem, as I think many people in America do. But but I figured to myself, like, the whole point of canning and jarring foods and preserving foods is that they should last forever. So, like, if this jar of Bon Maman says 2019 on it and I'm opening it 5 years later, it's probably okay. Like, if I were, you know, going down to the root cellar in my frontier home 150 years ago, I could grab a five-year-old jar of jam, right?
Oh, yeah. That was a great year for the berries, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think, Dan?
I would lean actually more towards burden, because not only do these dates cause stress, as Helen says, but we did an episode of the Sporkful podcast on this exact topic a couple years back, and I interviewed a professor about it. And she said, first of all, there is no standardized system. There is no government regulation that dictates what dates you have to have in your package or how you need to calculate them or what they need to mean. So, yes, not only are there the term expiration date is kind of outdated, because it's rare that it actually says expires on. Like Helen says, sometimes it says sell by, but often, more often, what you see is best by.
Mm-hmm.
So that really means nothing, because, like, okay, so it's not, so, okay, so it's a week past the best by date, so it's no longer at its best.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a week past my best by date, too.
Right. Some of us are past our primes, right? So the best buy date, which I think is the one I see most often, is really useless, because it's very subjective, and so it just causes stress. I think that I do wish there was some more standardized accepted system for this, because it is useful information. But
yeah,
that professor I spoke to said mostly just, like, trust your nose and your eyes and your tongue. Take a smell, take a little taste. If it smells and tastes and looks okay, then it's probably okay.
Yeah.
And if not, then not.
Yeah, that's what Tamar Adler has always kind of harped on too, in a really great way. It's just like, yeah, like, you have senses for a reason. And if it's weird, you probably shouldn't eat it. But if it's not weird, go for it, you know?
Yeah. Like, can yogurt go bad?
Yeah.
Like, isn't, but it's already... But I would just scrape the mold off and eat what's underneath.
Oh, I don't know that I would do that with yogurt.
Yeah, I mean, it's already gone bad. That's the whole idea of it.
Right, but like cheese, like, too.
Cheese, I think cheese just becomes a different cheese. It's like a Pokemon evolution.
Right. Cheese, you can definitely just cut off the mold and eat the other parts, right?
But sometimes the rest, if it tastes too blue cheese, like if whatever next cheese it has become tastes too funky to me, I won't do it.
I feel like we're all going to get sued.
For the record, by listening to this podcast, you release and hold harmless.
Yes, there you go.
Greta,
you,
Helen, and I, Sporkful LLC, Nerdette, WBEZ, and The New Yorker, from any any negative health outcomes you may have, or anything that may ever go wrong in your life as a result of listening to this podcast. You just agreed to this release by listening to the words I just said.
Oh, Dan, I'm so glad you're here to help cover us. That was beautiful. Helen, Dan, thank you both so very much for coming on. This was full delight.
Any time spent with you two is full delight, as far as I'm concerned.
All right, we've got more in just a minute.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Earlier this week, Nerdette producer Anna Bauman hit the road and joined the thousands of humans en route to see the full solar eclipse. Here is what it sounded like in a park in Indianapolis, surrounded by people who stopped to sit and wonder at our sky.
Bye-bye.
It's almost gone.
Whoa. Oh my goodness.
This is it, Lena. Wow. Are you watching?
Wow.
Hey.
Are you watching? Oh. Oh my goodness. Wow. Woo.
Can we take our glasses off?
No, you can take your glasses off.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You can see Venus.
Lena, what do you think?
It's so cool.
Really nighttime.
Oh no, I lost my glasses.
Is that a bat form? It's a bat.
It is.
Wow.
All right, that's it for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening. We would love to hear from you about Nerdette. As you know, WBEZ has announced they will no longer be making Nerdette, and we are going to be sticking around for a little bit longer. And in those episodes, we want to hear from you. We would love to know what Nerdette has meant to you over the years. We just got a really beautiful message from a longtime listener named Marcella. Here it is.
You have been my friends. You have been my companions in my moments of uncertainty during the pandemic, my first time moving out of my parents' house. This community, the Nerdette HQ, every interview you've ever done. I'm also a journalist, so learning through you has also been part of my enjoyment of this community. So thank you, and we'll follow you wherever you go. You have my axe and my sword and my ears.
Marcella, I love you so much. When I first heard that, I cried a lot. I am so grateful for you and for all of the rest of you who have been checking in and chiming in with your love for the show. And we would love to hear from you too. Just record yourself on your phone and send that audio file to nerdettepodcast@gmail.com. Nerdette is produced by me and Anna Bauman at WBEZ in Chicago. We are part of the NPR network. And Brendan Banaszak is our executive producer. We will see you next week.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.